Very
Hi.
good.
Okay, so I will call this meeting of the Municipal Services Committee to order. By some process of elimination, I have been asked to chair today in place of Peter, so bear with me. I guess the first item would be the adoption of minutes from last month. So can I get a motion to approve the January 17th minutes?
So moved, John Alcesor.
Thank you, John. A second?
Second, Andy Cirilli, Town of Plainville.
Thank you, Andy. Any changes or discussion or? Okay, so being none, I'll take a vote to adopt the minutes from January 17th. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions?
This is Kasia Percio. I'll abstain since I'm new to the group.
Thanks, Kasia. Okay. So with that, I know we have a presentation. So, but I guess let's go through report from. I don't have any anything to report today. So Matt, would you like to take it over?
Sure. Thank you so much, Grace. And I imagine Pauline and I can combine our reports and make it pretty concise for you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining today's meeting. Appreciate Grace stepping up to serve as our committee chair today. The only item I wanted to touch on is that we are working on the design and implementation of the RPIP grants we received, starting off with code enforcement with a real focus on building inspection and then assessment. And we conducted two meetings last week, and thank you to those of you who attended. And as we emphasized in those meetings, it's really going to be the needs, commitments that the participating towns are able to make that will shape how we develop and implement those programs. And for each, we talked about three potential models. One is a per diem model where we could hire part-time staff that could be assigned to work in various towns. One would be a sub-regional model where one town would take the lead and support some area towns. And then third was a full district model, which in many ways would be analogous to that of a health district and certainly take more time and effort to establish. But I thought we made a good start, and Pauline's going to be reaching out to schedule meetings with those towns that weren't able to attend. You know, this committee was very helpful in terms of shaping those RPIP applications, and your ongoing input will be very important to us. So that's all I've got. Pauline, not sure if there's anything you wanted to add before we get into our presentations. Thank you.
No, I don't have anything extra except that if you are interested and you don't get an email from me within the next day or two, but that's because you didn't originally sign up, but you still have time to sign up. So just please feel free to reach out to me if you're interested in either of those projects.
Okay, thank you, Pauline. So it looks like next on the agenda, we have a presentation from David Lukens of OPM on broadband mapping. So David, it's all yours.
Hi, can you all see my screen?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, I'm David Lukens. I'm the broadband mapping coordinator from the Office of Policy and Management. And I just wanted to come and give a general overview of what we've done at the state in terms of broadband mapping, and then give you a little bit of a briefing on the capital region and our broadband data for the capital region. I can't say CROG. It just does my head in to leave out the other C. I just can't do it. and then talk about some ways that we can cooperate moving forward. There are a few things that we're really gonna need some state and local cooperation on to make sure that they get done well. So it'd be great if we can, you know, just kind of open up that line of communication now. So first of all, many of you may have heard this somewhere, but just to make sure that everybody knows, we do have broadbandmaps.ct.gov for all of your broadband mapping needs in the state. You can download data sets directly there. You can look at maps. You can look at, you know, custom applications that show you the relationship of, for example, adoption and poverty. Whatever you want to look at, there's a lot of stuff there. Please do go check it out. We also have a unserved location report function that, you know, we've got 100 or so responses now where people have at least told us, you know, I have service, but it's not very good. And so any way that you can direct residents who want to tell us about that to our website, we can then make sure that it gets reported to the FCC as well. The FCC has also now published their broadband map. Both of these things kind of went up in November, but there are a lot of issues with the FCC map. Ours is also not perfect. And one of the things I'll talk about is how we're trying to square those up, but it's useful for all of you to at least have a look at what the FCC map shows, because you will see some weird stuff and it might give you some, or you might see something that you know that's correct. And we, you know, it can help us sort of start that dialogue where we make sure that everything is on the same page. So just in general, when we're looking at locations within the Capital Region, we're doing pretty okay. And this is the state for most of Connecticut. That you can see that tiny little red bar, that is the number of unserved locations. And just to make sure everyone understands, unserved in this case means there is no connection available that is above 25 megabits per second download and 3 megabits per second upload. So the, you know, the, that's kind of the maximum of a DSL connection. That would be a very low speed tier for a cable connection. You can't get fiber at that speed, right? So there are some locations around 2,000. It says 2,755 here because that's the number we actually have, but we know about 1,000 of those are not correct. We just can't 100% verify it because some of the ISPs are still cleaning that data, trying to correct some things. So we'll be back with a little bit better numbers next month. So we're continually refining this, but overall, there's not a huge problem, but there are 1,000 locations, even 1,000 locations within one cog is something to focus on, something to make sure that we improve. So we do have those locations. There are pretty much no underserved. Underserved would mean that there's, you know, a low speed cable connection or something like that. Throughout the state, there are almost no underserved locations. It's a couple hundred. So mostly we're dealing with places that just don't have access to service pretty much, or they have decent access through cable or fiber. In terms of where those locations are and how, you know, some of what these data cleaning problems are, you can see here on the map of the number of unserved locations per census block. So it's hard to really see anything specifically because they're very small, but we can see some really concentrated areas in Vernon, New Britain, up towards Granby, right? So some of those locations we have talked through with ISPs and they've told us actually we do serve that location. In other cases, providers, when they've submitted data to the FCC and we've tried to compare our data, we can see that something's wrong, and I'll show an example of that. In other cases, we have weird things where the FCC has a location and so we've added it into our database for now, but the Great Meadows, for example, in Wethersfield/Rocky Hill. I don't know if any of you have ever ridden bikes around there. I used to live near there. It's a pretty nice spot. So just says, oh, I went out of order. Apologies. But for example, this specific field is a broadband serviceable location according to the FCC. So I'm pretty sure it should not be. But I don't know if there's something somewhere that, you know, there are sod fields there. So we're still like in the process of making sure we verify before we tell the FCC, yeah, no, we definitely don't need service in this sod field. Another example is here in New Britain. This is the FCC map and this is Country Club Road. And you can see that on the same road, we have a lot of served locations and then suddenly unserved, then suddenly served again. This is pretty much impossible with network infrastructure. And so in our state maps, it doesn't look quite like this, but we were reported different addresses and we can see what they reported to the FCC. So this is something we have to clean up, and it just makes it that much more important that when residents know they can't get service, if they can report that to towns and towns report it to us, or they report it directly to us, it just gives us one more way that we can verify what we're doing and make sure that we have the best data possible. Overall though, like I said, you know, if we look at the Capital Region as a whole, there's about 65,000 locations that lack a broadband subscription compared to that 2,000 locations that lack access to a broadband subscription. So just like everywhere else in the state, this is primarily an issue of adoption more than access. That doesn't mean there aren't locations we need to fix, but the biggest thing that we need to be aware of is that a lot of people just don't sign up for a subscription. It may be an affordability issue. They may not be interested. They may be fed up with a provider. Those are all different and have different solutions. But the big problem here is adoption. And so we need to understand the variation in that across different area regions in the state and, you know, find the best solutions for each of those types of problems. And just to go into that a little bit more, not only do most residents in Connecticut, or not, excuse me, not most, do many residents in Connecticut not have a subscription at all, but many of them have subscriptions at speeds that the FCC would say aren't good enough. And so, you know, that's an individual consumer's choice, of course, but we have, you know, these 60,000 some that don't have a subscription in the capital region. Then we have another nearly 50,000 that have what we'd call an unserved subscription, that's below 25.3. And another huge chunk, over 250,000, that have an underserved subscription, so that's below 120. So a lot of this is consumer choice, like what do you actually use your internet for? But it also suggests that maybe a big part of what we need to be working on is making sure that consumers are educated about their options, what those options can do for them in terms of telework and telehealth, et cetera. And that's something that the state is working on, but it really helps to get feedback from localities. You know, how can we contribute there? Who in your community is doing that kind of work? And that leads me to, I'm gonna come back to this because that leads me to this survey, which I've sent out to everyone through different means, but I can post this link in the chat as well. I have a survey for community anchor institutions, and this is targeting places that we might not know about. So we know where the libraries are, we know about schools, but there are other places in your communities that interact directly with residents and help them get online. So if you have places like that, a senior center, a local youth, you know, after school program that maybe isn't directly with a school, anything like that, where residents get help getting online, get training, learn how to make a resume. We might not have them in our database of community anchors, but they could be eligible for funding through digital equity, the digital equity program, and the broadband equity access and deployment program, the BEAD program. So there are two big pots of money coming to Connecticut that we want to make sure doesn't just go to wires in the ground. We need those sometimes, but we also need to make sure that people have a way to use the internet productively. So I'll put this link in the chat as well as the service availability report. And if you can just, you know, send those out somewhere, make sure that if you know an institution is doing that kind of work, if you can pass that to them, that would be really helpful. And the last thing I would say is just in terms of squaring up that FCC data with the OPM data, it's an ongoing process. We've already done two challenges to tell the FCC like, hey, that isn't there, this isn't here. But again, if everyone can just have a quick look at the FCC map and see like does something look really wrong? And we can start a feedback loop with localities and the state and the FCC. We can make sure that when the money comes in from BEAD, we can deploy it as quickly as possible. So I'm doing my best on a statewide level, but in terms of like looking at every individual address, it's a lot. So any feedback we can get from anyone is super helpful there. That's it for me. I'll put those links in the chat. Does anybody have any questions?
Grace, I can ask a question and probably get us going a little bit here.
Please do so.
David, thank you so much for your informative presentation and all the good work you're doing here. I also wanted to note that Eric Snowden is on the call today. Eric Snowden is our lead GIS and IT person here at CROG and has worked very closely with the members of the OPM team and other GIS folks at the state for many, many years now. David, could you talk a little bit about the distinction between last mile, middle mile, et cetera, you know, that we read about and, you know, that would be helpful for the lay people on the call?
Sure. So the basic idea when people are talking about last mile, they mean the actual connection from the backbone, or so the sort of the larger infrastructure, the internet, so to speak, to a home, right? And so in many cases, what is missing is that last mile connection. And that is especially true in Connecticut. Connecticut has actually a very good fiber backbone, right? We have a lot of capacity. Crown Castle owns a lot of that. CEN leases a lot of it from Crown Castle. And that is then what other providers can hook into and connect to your home. What can be challenging with last mile connections is that, especially with cable, if you are very far from the public right of way, there's a lot of degradation in signal the farther away you go from the backbone. And so you have to put in amplifiers to get that signal. And I didn't really talk about this because it's not as big of an issue in the capital region, but a lot of the unserved locations in the state are what we'd call non-standard installations or long driveways. And that's because the primary provider in the area is cable. And they, in order to install cable to the home that's like, say, 600 feet from the road in a case of a long driveway or something like that, it takes a lot of infrastructure to actually get that connection to the home. So then they charge a fee. And so in some that does exist in the capital region, it's just not as much because it's denser. But so that last mile part is what a lot of the ARPA funds are sort of targeted towards, and trying to make sure that we can get to someone's home, because we know that the backbone is not really the problem in Connecticut in most cases.
Thank you, David.
I had one, David. As far as determining what is a qualifying anchor institution and what's not, is there a real solid definition for that? I think we had discussed that maybe it was a little bit fluid.
It is nebulous, but I think it is nebulous on purpose in this case. So I have requested clarification from the NTIA a few times, and every time they've told me the same thing. It is a community support other community support organizations that facilitate greater use of broadband is the language from the NOFO. And so I asked, I was like, so a church that helps people make resumes? They're like, yeah, sure. Like, oh, okay. A daycare? Yes. So all of the things that we would normally think of, your schools, your libraries, yes. But, you know, a workforce training program that is associated with, that comes out of a church, that they operate in a church or a mosque or what have you. Anything that is helping people get online probably counts. There is no distinction between profit and nonprofit. That was made in the NOFO. And when I asked, they said that's correct. So it could be, a business that as part of their, social responsibility work helps train people up in some way. So we're working with providers to get information on things they do when they bring Wi-Fi into boys and girls clubs, et cetera. So all of that stuff could count. And we just want to make sure that we have that entire set of community organizations mapped.
Go ahead, John. Nope, John, you muted yourself.
You think after a couple of years you get used to that?
You were all set to go.
Never do.
We ought to all think about our own organizations, like our rec programs. We run after-school programs and they do homework help and our senior centers that may have slow speeds. So I don't think we think, or farmers markets where we're using cash, Venmo stuff and the current providers can't handle the flow of that. Fares, food, all the transfer stations, all those things for transactional things. We do a lot more, or we should do a lot more than we do sometimes due to capabilities. And we forget it. We forget about it sometimes.
Thank you, John. David, I have a question about, so the data that you're gathering now, is that being used to design a program to distribute these ARPA funds that are intended to expand broadband access? So when we talk about these community, I'm sorry, I don't remember the term you use, like these centers of these community centers or these hubs, are that, is there the potential that once we identify these places, they can become eligible to receive this funding?
Yes. So I am not in charge of any money. So I can only tell you what I give people in terms of data and why. But so there are three sort of pots of money. There's the digital equity program. There is the BEAD program, which is what the broadband equity, accessibility, and deployment. And then there's ARPA. So ARPA is really targeted at that last mile, making sure that unserved locations are going to get connected. And DEEP should be releasing in the next month or so. I cannot give them a deadline. Again, I don't make decisions about anything. But they will be releasing the specific program parameters for that, because that's pretty flexible. On the other hand, BEAD is very specific, and that is at least $100 million coming into the state of Connecticut. First, we must fix all unserved locations. But in Connecticut, we have about 7,000 to 8,000. We can do it. Like, we've got, that's more than enough money. So then it goes to underserved. As I mentioned earlier, there's a couple hundred. After that, number three is community anchor institutions. And for community anchor institutions, that program allows us to make sure that eligible community anchor institutions have a gigabit by gigabit synchronous connection. So probably that's through CEN, the Connecticut Education Network, but it wouldn't have to be. You know, we're not trying to force anyone to do any one thing there. Just if we know that so some libraries aren't connected to CEN and maybe we could help them, but maybe there's a senior center that runs a couple digital literacy programs and it's in a town hall in a less dense part of the state, they might be able to, you know, hook both of those things up at once, using the justification that, yes, like, we do provide digital literacy training, but we can then help make sure that there's really high speed internet heading there, right? So for what it's worth, I see a message from Robin. The digital equity program then is run by the Commission for Education and Technology, CET. And they are then focused on more the use part, right? So we have this general, okay, we're making sure that there are connections so that people can use it, but then what do we do to make sure that people are using it more effectively? And that will be under the digital equity program. We are currently in the planning stages of that grant. Once we have a plan, we submit the plan, then there's around $18 million in funding for those programs. So then that we could use at the same community anchor. We help them get a good connection with BEAD, and then we could help them fund a program that they can demonstrate has helped work and helped get people online. So we're trying to make sure in Connecticut, because yay Connecticut, all of these programs are housed in different agencies, but we are trying very hard to keep those tied together. And that one of the things that I want, the reason I'm doing this CAI survey is so that I can have a piece of data that I say, okay, hey, CET, you have to look over here, and DEEP, you have to look over here. And we all have to make sure that we're putting these funds together in a way that is amplifying the spend rather than, you know, I'm gonna put a few dollars over here and a few dollars over here and neither of them help each other out. So we are trying. And the more data we can get from localities about what's working for you, you know, do you have a digital equity plan in your town? Like anything like that, the more that we can get in terms of feedback of what's happening at the local level, the better we can understand and the better we can sort of map this out.
For everybody else, I'm on Connecticut Education Technology Council. If you have questions, I'd be glad to help.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions for David? Eric, did you have a question?
I'm good, thanks. I just wanted to thank David for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you. And you'll share the links to what you need us to to take a look at and comment on?
I believe they are both in the chat. Are they not in the chat? Did I fail?
Maybe they're in the chat. Hold on.
They are. Okay. In the chat. And if you can email Kim the presentation, we can also send that out to the group, as well as people who may have missed the meeting.
I will do that.
Just the two links are the same, though, in the chat. I don't know if they're supposed to be different, but.
I will fix that and send it back.
All right.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
All right. So we can move on to an update on the Infrastructure and Jobs Act. I think, Matt, is that you?
Yeah, I can kick it off. Thank you, Grace. So as everyone on the call knows, we've been spending a lot of time and effort on the bipartisan infrastructure law, providing materials to our towns to help them take advantage of these unique funding opportunities. You know, we realize it's a lot of information coming virtually all the time. And I really want to commend Elizabeth Sanderson and Kyle Scheel and other members of our team for trying to really make the information digestible and serve as a resource to our towns. We've got some ideas, and I think Elizabeth will get into that a little bit today in terms of how we can make the information even a little bit easier for you all to understand and the role that CROG can play. I also want to commend and thank the team, Elizabeth and Roger Cron and others here at CROG who wrote the successful application under the Safe Streets for All program for the planning grant that we will utilize to update our regional safety plan. And that plan is so important because it becomes the basis of implementation projects. So I'd like to now turn it over to Elizabeth, who's going to give us an update with support from Kyle and others as needed. But we're really looking for your questions and feedback today as well. Elizabeth?
Thank you, Matt. And hello, everybody. Elizabeth Sanderson, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law Coordinator at CROG. So if you have questions of anything that I'm presenting or nothing's, you know, not as clear, please reach out. As Matt mentioned, we were awarded the planning grant, and one of the strategies we'll have for round two, which we are expecting to come out this April for the Safe Streets and Roads for All program, is for towns to look at the regional transportation safety plan from that we have created already and we'll be updating as part of the planning grant, but that can help inform the round two implementation grant applications. So this first bullet includes a link to a strategy that we've drafted, which includes identifying priority projects in your towns, and then, you know, moving on to next steps. But if you could take a look at that PDF, it's on page 3 of the PDF, begins the strategy. With it, within that is also a link to the Regional Transportation Safety Plan, which includes the priority projects that were created in that 2015 plan. And the next bullet here, the Federal Transit Administration has launched their Area of Persistent Poverty program. There's only a few eligible towns in Connecticut or in CROG: East Hartford, Enfield, Hartford, Manchester, Mansfield, and New Britain, and the Greater Hartford. Sorry, plug my battery in. Thought I had more time. There was a grant already awarded last year, so the likelihood of another transit may be unlikely. But if you have a project that, you know, if you're in the community that and you have a project, then please let us know if you're interested in that program. We're also looking to hear from you if there have been any applications that you've applied for. We're trying to create an open line of communication between the Connecticut bipartisan infrastructure law team, the state team, as well as the Department of Transportation, the State Department of Transportation. So if there's any programs that you've applied for that are related to BIL, please let us know. And then DOT, US DOT prepared a memo summarizing their, we prepared a memo summarizing, highlighting the key funding opportunities that would be most applicable to CROG in the region. And that is available on our website as well as linked here. And we'll be working on probably narrowing that list down as well in the coming months as we try to really target certain projects that are of significant importance in the region, just so it's not so overwhelming, but open to feedback. And next slide. And just a few bullet points to keep in mind as we are approaching spring and summer. Safe Streets and Roads for All, round two, as I mentioned, April 2023. There's also the Bridge Investment Program in summer 2023. And just keeping these in mind for as you're preparing your budgets too, keep that there's a local match requirement for many of the grants. And we wanna make sure that we have funding available to follow through if we are awarded grants. And just a link to the website that we've created that highlights the different programs that have come out in this first year that we've been tracking. And then each program will be updated as the new notices of funding opportunities are coming out. And not all are related to DOT, most are, but there are some related from EPA and Department of Energy. So there's quite a bit of information on each of the different federal agencies that are reporting. And then a note here about the Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainability and Equity. That's the RAISE program. The application due date is fast approaching next Tuesday, so a week from today. We're working with a couple of towns already. And just throwing it out there that if you are working on an application independently and you would like a letter of support, then to please let us know. I think that's all I have. So thank you. If there's any questions, happy to answer.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Just a couple of additional comments before we open it up for questions, Grace. So a lot of this work is happening at the Transportation Committee level. And that is comprised, as you know, of your public works directors or your town engineers. And an idea that we presented to them at their recent meeting, and we're going to continue the discussion next month, in an effort to be more strategic about these upcoming opportunities, you know, we want to build a bit of a queue or a list, if you will, for the four or five programs that make the most sense for CROG and its members, like Safe Streets for All, like the RAISE program. And we're going to be asking the members of the Transportation Committee in the near future, you know, send us a list of your top projects, the top projects in your CIP, for example, that you think might qualify under one of these federal funding programs. And we'll screen your application or your projects. We'll screen your projects against the grant criteria to determine whether or not we think they would be eligible and competitive. So again, we're taking this step in an effort to be more strategic here, to have a list of projects that are closer to being ready to go so that it's not a scramble every time a NOFO comes out. And we also want to assist you by conducting some of the screening at our level, because we know these NOFOs are technical and people have limited time to review them. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And Grace, we're happy to take any questions or feedback committee members may have.
Thank you, Matt. I think that's going to be a very helpful tool. I don't know how many times I have to read a NOFO and don't understand what's being asked of me. So that will be helpful. John, do you have a question, comment? You're on mute. There you go.
So interesting that you're looking at what we've been asking directly under the projects that we may go to our congressmen or senators. So do you want us to send or wait till we know where to send it to, applications that we've already submitted that may have not been funded or may have been funded through Congress, but not the Senate.
Elizabeth, do you want to comment on what your preference is? And again, reiterate why we're looking to do this so we can issue support letters, track applications, et cetera, across the region.
Yeah, I guess I want to just understand the question that you've submitted to for the federal programs, but have not been awarded.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, we already have an application. We already have kind of budgets. We already have a concept. We already identified a grant agency. But, you know, they especially congressmen, have a limit on how many they can get. And then they have to go through and get it through the reconciliation budget. And like we had a major sidewalk project that made it through the Congress, and in a reconciliation, the Senate said, the states are getting a lot of sidewalk money. We don't want to give it here. And, you know, I actually have a project number at state Connecticut DOT that just says earmark. So it's frustrating that, you know, we got so far along. Now I don't have the money to finish the last loop around our lake. So you could walk all the way around the lake. But I also looked for an emergency operations center and also submitted one for a water tower, which, believe it or not, there's no federal funding that I could find for water towers for fire suppression. And when you have a lot of wells, you don't usually have a water tower. And I may lose a business that's been here since the 1800s because the only way they can get fire insurance is through Lloyd's of London. And I can't believe that nobody's looking at economic development due to fire suppression. Also, by the way, it means I can't do affordable housing, but you know, what the heck, you know, that those are just details the state doesn't want to hear.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And just as another thought, we have been meeting with towns and have come across with certain similar common issues with a water supply or a thing. So that's something that we're kind of working on in the background. But yes, please send me the grants that and the projects. I think that'll be really informative for this as we create this list of priority projects for each town. So I can put my email in the chat.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Does anyone else have any questions, comments? No? Okay. Well, thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you, Matt. We'll see what happens next. And then I think our next item is a report about the Human Services Coordinating Council.
Yeah, Grace, this is Matt. I can take the lead on this, and then Pauline can provide some historical reference. Wanted to tee the conversation up for this meeting and ideally carry it forward to the next meeting. Really looking for your help with reviving or potentially restructuring our Human Services Coordinating Council. This is a creature of state statute. And every cog in the state is supposed to be staffing a council and having at least one meeting per year. I will tell you, very few cogs across the state are complying with the statute. You know, it might have been something that was well-intentioned at the time, but it has not worked out as well in practice. So what we've done before, and I'll ask Pauline to elaborate in a moment, in years past, is we've worked to schedule meetings of human services staff, you know, the folks in your human services departments, your social services department, et cetera, to try to talk about topics of interest to them. I think the most recent conversations we had were probably in 2021 around homelessness or houselessness and panhandling and the intersection of those two. And how in some communities, human services workers were coordinating with local police departments to best serve those communities. But it's always been a challenge to get people to the meeting. I think there are also state agencies that are supposed to be designating staff to attend. I think we've rarely, if ever, seen those folks. So, you know, really would like to get your thoughts and ideas in terms of how you think we could be helpful utilizing this council to serve our human services staff in our member towns. Pauline, can you talk, you want to add a little bit more about the most recent work in the council and what we've done in years past?
Yeah, I think Matt, you captured it. I mean, at the very beginning of the Human Services Coordinating Council meetings, we did an analysis of dial-a-ride programs as well to see if there was some opportunity there to consolidate or help, and that was goes back quite a few years. We've been meeting basically to fulfill the statutory requirement. I think that's a good way to describe it. We've had meetings on mental health, opioid crisis, and different presentations along those lines. But it's not a council that has been active in terms of work product or results. I think that's probably a good way to describe it. Mostly presentations and information sharing.
Thank you very much, Pauline. So Grace, again, you know, we're looking for your feedback in terms of how you all think we could be helpful working through this council. You know, maybe even next meeting, if you wanted to invite your human services directors or social services directors who could weigh in on the topic as well.
I think that would be a great idea. The one thing that kind of sprang right into my head that I hear about a lot from our senior center coordinator is just food insecurity amongst our senior, our older adults. You know, things that we're seeing a lot more people come into our, you know, our free lunch programs at the senior center. We've added one. We're feeding a tremendous amount of people. And, you know, it's just, we know that at least they come into the senior center and they get one good balanced hot meal a day. And I'm sure, if you know, it's happening here, it's probably happening everywhere. And I don't know what necessarily the solution is, but just we're seeing it in overwhelming numbers. So does anybody else have any? John, is your hand up from before or? Okay.
So for our next meeting, should we carry this as a business item and, you know, see if people could invite their human services directors?
Yeah, I think that's I would like to see that. Andy, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I was just going to agree. I think that's a good idea. Plainville actually just had a coordinating meeting with our human services, you know, staff in town, senior center, youth services, social services, police chief, fire marshal, just trying to coordinate services. We get quite a few phone calls from residents in need for meals or they're out of heat. And with the cold spell we had a few weeks ago, there were some people who were in need of some type of accommodations. So we were trying to do that internally. So I think it's a great idea to bring these people to the table here. So I'll be happy to extend an invitation.
Thank you. Yeah, so I think let's continue it to next month. And just a reminder to members to reach out to their social services staff and invite them.
Great, thank you.
Cool. So now I think we're up to municipal information sharing. So kind of our catch-all category. Does anybody have anything they'd like to bring up? Yes, John.
A little slow on the take here, but I was on those original committees. One thing that we may want to talk about is what we're going to do with the opioid money. Mm-hmm. You know, our human services administrator here, I suggested she reach out to other towns and invite people to participate. And I think you're up to like 21 towns now. So no one really knows how the money should be used wisely. And that's an integration of a lot of different agencies, not just human services. So I would suggest that that might be a focus, not necessarily exclusive, but there's money available and we should spend it wisely, or those agencies that are giving the money may not have to give more. So just a focus point that may get people to attend.
It's a great idea, John. Anyone else? Once, twice? Okay. We have an item called future agenda items, other question mark. So Matt, do you wanna, or Pauline?
I can take the lead and ask Pauline to elaborate. So one is what we just talked about. You know, what's gonna be the future of the Human Services Coordinating Council? How can we structure it to best suit the needs of our member towns? Do want to continue the conversation we started about how we best support our land use and development community. You know, we are in the process of selecting our director of regional planning and development, and hopefully we will have that finalized and an announcement by next month's meeting. So I'll coordinate with Peter in terms of when we bring that back. We'll also want to provide you with an update on our Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy, or SEDS. Kyle, Maureen, and I do staff that committee. We should have a draft plan in April. And I think it would be interesting to share it with this committee, maybe in the May timeframe, so that you're aware of it and can provide feedback as well. We'll continue to give you updates on the RPIP program as we move along. Also, during this meeting, I got a very good suggestion from Robin, you know, that we periodically provide updates and solicit your feedback on the status of our waste management project as well. Pauline, anything I might have missed there?
No, I don't think so. I think those are... I think if I would also say if the Municipal Services Committee members have ideas or thoughts on topics that you'd like to see or hear, or you'd want us to discuss or work on, please feel free to reach out to any one of us.
Excellent. Okay. Does anybody have any thoughts at the moment, or not?
Geese, yes, control. How do we control geese?
Geese? Okay.
Is that a really serious question, John?
They're delicious, John.
Believe it or not, it is, Pauline. They are the bane of a Parks and Rec director's existence.
It's really tough. It's really tough to deal with them. And you end up having to close beaches because of the poop. Mm-hmm. We've experimented with a poop sweeper, believe it or not, to make one, imported from Britain. But it doesn't work on beaches. It works in the parks. Really, really effective on grass, but you can't sweep up sand. So a goose poop symposium, you'd find your rec directors looking for solutions. And I remember a story about Southington where the TV cameras were following as DEP was coming in to not allow the eggs. Saying you're killing all the geese, and Mark's suggestion: you can get a permit to shoot them if you feed them to homeless people. It's in the statutes.
Okay,
it's a problem, and you know, maybe Craw got own dogs to chase them away.
Okay, anybody else?
My dog would definitely go after the geese, for sure. He wouldn't be able to catch them, though.
You know, Grace, I could see a retired town manager with a fleet of border collies or something patrolling the region's beaches.
John, you interested?
There's a lot of solutions. There's like annoying little blinking lights you put in the ground. They're solar powered and they blink. They don't like those.
We've tried them all, John. Nothing works.
There's a grape juice extract, which is great until it rains, but it really
tried peppermint work. Too. That didn't work.
So you'd be surprised how many people are doing stuff.
We need more hunters in Connecticut. That's the problem.
But you can do things with bushes and everything else. They don't like to climb near bushes because they're worried that there's foxes there. And we had those fake coyote things, but the kids stole them and that didn't work that well. So we spent a lot of time on this.
Oh my goodness.
We actually hire a young man. He arrives early and shovels poop for an hour every day.
There you go.
Really not making it up.
Nope.
All right. Well, on that note, unless anybody has anything else, I think we can adjourn. All right. Well, we will see you all in March. Thank you for bearing with me.
Oh, great job, Grace. Thank you.
All right. We'll see you guys soon. Bye-bye.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Grace, for pinch hitting.